Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, this is Jessica with
Megan,
and we're here with our very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Wayne Gladstone.
And Wayne, aside from the fact that you did grow up in Syosset, which we'll be hitting you up for at some point in the future, how did we come about this interview? Would you like to talk a little bit about your podcast and what we're going to talk about today?
Well, sure. First of all, I'm very happy to be helping out Syosset Public Library, which did the good deed of having all three of my novels on its shelves. The Internet Apocalypse Trilogy. Sometimes I see them, but you have all three, and God bless you for the work you do. I do a Twilight Zone podcast called Intangible Quarter, although I don't know how much I'm kind of fading it out.
No, don't do that. I know, like, real life gets in the way.
Well, no, I am doing a different one now called Contrarian Court that has nothing to do with Twilight Zone. But I am a huge Twilight Zone fan, and I did actually start the podcast because it's what I wanted to talk about. And I got to meet some real Twilight Zone authorities like Mark Dawidziak, who wrote a book called Everything I Needed to Learn, I Learned in the Twilight Zone. Everything I Need to Know, I Learned in the Twilight Zone. And became friends with a guy named Nick Parisi, who's on the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation. He lives on Long Island, and I'm sure he'd love to come talk to you about Twilight Zone and even sell his new book, which is a biography of Rod Serling.
So that's actually pretty cool, because I didn't mean to imply that podcasting isn't real life, by the way, before. You know, just when you're balancing different things and your media, you know, and your full-time job. That was basically what I meant. That was now I'm being awkward.
No, that's fine. He did a reading from his new biography at Comac Public Library a couple of weeks ago. So I'm sure he'd swing by in any event. And Anne Serling, Rod's daughter, who wrote a great book called My Father as I Knew Him. So it didn't bring me tremendous success. I didn't monetize it for $1 million. But in the course of a year, I sort of became a Twilight Zone expert myself just by all the reading and interviewing I had done, which is nice.
So, of course, you know, we might ask for those references in the future, because one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast in a timely manner is because 4th of July, and I don't think, Megan, it's not on Sci-Fi anymore for 4th of July. It's on...
They've had it on decades.
Do you know offhand the marathons that they have twice a year? They used to have one on Sci-Fi New Year's, which was 2 days,
right.
And then they'd have one on the 4th of July, but they faded out the 4th of July one, I think, and another station is picking it up. But if we could do another one around New Year's, Twilight Zone, because there's endless things to talk about when you talk about the Twilight Zone.
Absolutely, absolutely. It holds up tremendously well. It sort of holds up better than the 80s reboot or the 2000s reboot, or arguably it might be more timely than the episodes that are coming out right now.
I think, though, of all the reboots, this one seems to be the best. That's just my opinion.
I don't know the 2000 reboot very well. I disliked two episodes I saw. The 80s reboot, I just got again on box set, and there's about 10 fantastic stories, and the rest are kind of atrocious. I really liked the very first episode, The Comedian, mm-hmm. written by Alex Rubens, who was cool enough to do my podcast. A couple other ones I think are okay, but they just don't feel like Twilight Zones to me. They're not compressed stories. They're sprawling.
Well, I know there's a theory that they're all connected somehow.
I liked in The Comedian at the end of the episode how they make him part of the audience, and that was like definitely something that was pure Twilight Zone, but you don't get that feel. I understand what you mean in the other episodes, that this
right.
is all a story condensed within an hour's time.
Right. In fact, the first episode, The Comedian, it did feel like a Twilight Zone, but it felt like the fourth season, hour-long Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that, exactly.
Like Twilight Zones. But, you know, what? There's this dreamlike quality that you get from The Twilight Zone, and part of it is because it deals with fantastic conceits. But to me, that's a very small part of it. To me, the compression is vital. You just get a taste of so many things. So many things are implied, and so much is going on. It's told so quickly that we have to fill in the gaps. And that's what I think creates the dream state more than any special effect or fantastical magic lamp or whatever. And I really miss it in most of the reboots and in most anthology storytelling, whether it's Tales from the Crypt or Tales from the Dark Side. It's a hard thing to achieve, and I don't think anyone has ever done it better than Rod Serling.
So one of the things that I asked for us to do before we started was to prepare our top and bottom three episodes.
Right.
So, Wayne, would you like to go first with your top three?
I'm trying to remember what I told you my third favorite was, because it always... Oh, I know. I remember. Yeah.
I could pull it up here because I have the original emails, but go ahead.
I remember now. Right. Okay. Well, because I've watched them... I mean, I watched Twilight Zone my whole life, and I watched it on the marathons, and I watched it on Channel 11, and I watched it in the morning when I was a kid. But really, when I started watching them incessantly was when I got Netflix several years ago, and they were on Netflix except for season four. So my favorite episodes changed because when you watch them 50, 60 times, you notice different things. And my favorite became The Passersby, which is no one's favorite, but which I think is sensational. And it's the one at the end of the Civil War, and all the soldiers are coming home, and there's a woman on her porch. And, well, I don't know. I always think it's ridiculous to worry about spoilers when the show's been on.
Yeah, at this point, we're way past spoilers. We're not even talking Game of Thrones, which has already been spoiled for everybody at this point anyway, but go ahead.
Right. So basically, she realizes ultimately that not only is she dead, everyone she's seeing on the road is dead. And it ends with Lincoln as the last casualty of the Civil War. And I just think it's a beautiful, beautiful episode. Should I just run to the next two?
Yeah, go ahead. And then we can kind of go around and also talk about maybe some that we think are overrated or underrated.
Yeah.
Obviously, The Passerby to you is an underrated episode.
Absolutely underrated. The only thing I don't like about it is, but this is a problem that's endemic through almost every Twilight Zone, the lead actor, who's great, is too old for the role. He's supposed to be almost boyish, a boy who goes off to war, and he's 50 years old.
So much. I think I have like an old that my brother got me, like a paperback from the Twilight Zone, and it's something like, you know, stories for young kids, and like everybody in the Twilight Zone seemed decades older than their characters were
right.
supposed to be.
Right. They're all having midlife crises at 35, and they're all played by people who are 45, which is strange. But number two is Five Characters in Search of an Exit, which used to be my number one, and which some people hate.
It's not my favorite, I'll admit. But, you know, because I also think that the theme, the ending spoiler in that, like, I feel like it's done in several other episodes too, but it's not bad, and I think it's growing on me.
The ending is, to me, almost a lot of people, I think, who love Twilight Zone for the twist hate that because they don't like the twist. But to me, the ending of that one is irrelevant because it's just all about it's just existentialism. It's just about what is the meaning of life. And he takes an incredibly weighty topic like the meaning of life, and he does it in 23 minutes. And because he's not nihilistic, because he's not dark, he takes this very dark, dark, dark episode where life is seemingly meaningless, and we're all in the bin, being discarded, and he makes it gentler, and he says, perhaps they are unloved only for the moment.
And Toy Story 3 tried to go that route too.
And the third one.
Megan, go ahead. Did you want to add something?
No, I was just thinking back, though. It was like they must have taken some of this for Toy Story because it was just a lot of that I saw when I saw that episode.
Yeah, that's funny. I didn't think about that until just this minute.
Well, the last one, it just, I just like it more each year. I used to dislike it, and then I thought it was okay, and then I thought it was pretty good, and now it's one of my favorites, and it's I Am the Night, Color Me Black, which some people say, and I understand why, is almost an overly simplistic thing. They're going to publicly execute a man, and the whole town is dark, and then the whole world is getting dark, and a Martin Luther King figure says it's all our hatred, and light's going to go out forever. And if you look at it just like that, it's very simplistic. But the reason I love it is in the body of it, in the nuts and bolts of it. It's not simplistic at all. The guy they're killing is a radical white guy who killed a Klansman. So he's basically like Antifa. He's basically a radical leftist who killed a racist. And then you have a King character who's saying, oh, there's too much hate, there needs to be love. And he's basically, there's almost like a Malcolm X Martin Luther King debate going on, and the guy who's being hung almost calls out the preacher character and saying, you just want to get in good with the white community, you just want to be loved by the majority. And he says,
that's pretty razor sharp for the time period too.
Right now
I'm just thinking, like, going back, you know, that's edgy without, I don't, you know, in probably, like, in the best way.
Right. And he says, just the last thing I'll say is, he says in his defense, well, there, all there is the majority. The minority must have died on the cross 2,000 years ago. Heavy, heavy stuff. And no one talks about those internal parts when they talk about that episode. They just go, well, everything got dark.
When I was a kid, I didn't get it because I was very young. And I started watching Twilight Zone when I was extremely young, and it was on Channel 13. And I still had my parents' old, like, dial TV, because that's all I, you know, that's what I had. And then, you know, obviously, like, times changed and it was on Sci-Fi. But I didn't get that episode when I was younger. I mean, of course, you learn about the civil rights movement when you're young. But to me, it was just like, it was long and it was drawn out. And I'm like, what is going on? But, you know, when I was older, I got it. And I agree with you on those points.
Yeah, so I still love most of the classic ones, but it's these sleepers that really became my favorites.
Okay, so Megan, would you like to mention your top three?
Sure. So my favorite episode, I have to say, is Midnight Sun, because I think he just takes, like, a very seemingly, like, very over the top science fiction-y episode, and he makes it very in depth. Of just explaining, like, the basic needs of people, like, the main character, like, this is, like, she is trying to be an artist, and she hasn't really created anything, you know, worthwhile until, like, this major event happens, and then there's the sun is moving closer to the earth, and it's just a beautiful portrayal of trying to survive throughout odds, and I think it's about, like, humanity, like, what do we do in these situations, how do we change as people, and at the end, the twist at the end is perfect, because it's just like the complete opposite of what you think is going to be the best situation isn't. So it just is in life, it's just, you know, it's nothing is really is in extreme is the best, like, we have to meet somewhere in the middle of things. So
that's one of my favorite episodes too, and for two reasons. One, sure, there's a lot of sexism, but dated to the time stuff in the Twilight Zone. But not her. She's, like, the most empowered, maybe the most empowered character in the entire Twilight Zone universe.
But I do think, and when I get to my first episode, I will say, I have strong opinions also about the female character in Nick of Time. But we'll get back to that in a second,
right.
I think, you know. But continue.
She's an artist. She can carry a gun. She's compassionate. And so the second thing that I love about the episode is that, see, if it were Black Mirror, it would be totally different. Everyone would be eating each other as cannibals. And there are episodes where people turn on each other, right? Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, The Shelter.
Mm-hmm.
But this is all about human kindness. Every person in this is compassionate and kind. They all take care of each other. And even the one man who breaks in ultimately apologizes. That's why I love it.
And that was an hour long, correct? Was that
no,
one? That one wasn't
an
hour long. Why did I think that one was an hour long?
Well, it seems like it's such a long day. You really get the feeling like the whole film is actually melting as you're watching it. Like, that's the amazing thing. Like, everything is just falling apart within these 30 minutes. But then,
They did it. They
it's
did
just a beautiful, like, the three actors of that were great.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So next.
So my second favorite is Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? And I love this one because the twist isn't something you would basically expect. And I think the whole cast of characters just really, like, play off of each other very well. And it's just, it's funny, it's weird. And at the end, it's like, well, maybe there's room for, you know, a sequel to another episode of this. You know, it's just like, you don't, it leaves open a lot of, like, open questions about, I think, like, alien life and, you know. It's just a fun episode.
And what's great is no matter how many times I watch it, I mean, I know who, you always know who the real alien is, but it's always like a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah, it's a surprise. Well, yes, I feel the same. I could watch that episode is probably one I could rewatch the most amount of times and still be entertained. Yeah. And my third favorite is Willoughby.
Which is amazing.
This episode's amazing in so many ways, but I think it's a callback to Rod Serling. I think some of the strongest episodes have to deal with the difficulty we have in adapting to modern life. And he came from Binghamton area, maybe Vestal, I think, is where his hometown was. And I think that this was his calling to go back to that world, like maybe as a child. And it's about living in this modern life, you know, push, 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 what he says. But it's really true. Like, you know, we can't survive in this fast-paced world, which is still very timely today. Like, we need to remember our past and find.
Do you know there's a big debate about that, though? There's two sides.
Yes. What is the other side?
Well, no. Everyone agrees with what Meg just said. But Meg, right?
Yeah, that's fine. Meg.
Well, no, because it's a lot like walking distance, right? With the one where the guy walks into the town he grew up in, and he's a I like walking distance a little bit better, but that's probably my fourth favorite. But I like both. But at the end, right, he gets off at Willoughby. He walks out of his life, and he goes to this quiet, nice, idyllic town. But when we cut back to reality, they say he jumped off the train, and he's being carted away by Willoughby and Sons. Now, many people view the episode as, he escaped to a safe place. I mean, Rod almost says he did that. To me, the episode is to long for the past, to not deal with your reality, is to long for death, is to give up, is to check out of life. And it's a very negative, not a negative ending, but like an instructive, moralistic ending. Half the people view it and go, he's free!
It like a glass half open, as this, glass half full, glass half empty.
This is not a right answer. I mean, Quinciac and Parisi, they both view it very positively. I view it as a saying, don't get lost in the past. How do you view it?
Me? I view it as he committed suicide, and that's very sad.
I think Megan has a happier place with it. Like
but that's nice because, like, to me, like, I wouldn't have thought of people viewing it as happy.
What I love about that episode is we don't know what's exactly rooted in reality and what is in this dreamlike state. And I think that's what makes it amazing because I think you're supposed to still debate at that at the end, and you're supposed to be. They were thinking of it that way, I think, when they wrote it.
Like, I had, like, a very similar debate about Pan's Labyrinth, that movie by Guillermo del Toro. Right, yeah, with the guy with the eyes in his hands, whose name I can't remember at the moment.
He's on Star Trek Discovery now.
I meant the actual character, what the monster's name was, because I literally cannot remember. But, you know, like, when we saw that movie, the question is, okay, like, is she really the Moon Princess, or did she die? And that had a very, you know, like, if she's really the Moon Princess, like, that's positive. But if she died, although, you know, the fascist stepfather is gone, and I guess that's positive. So
I saw the movie once many years ago. I don't remember anything other than that.
The guy with the eyes. Yeah. It's a really great movie. It's very pretty. It's very Guillermo del Toro. Yes.
I did not like Shape of Water, though.
No.
I disliked it greatly.
But going into one of our less favorites episodes, the Bewitching Pool, I think that this is Willoughby is more successful because switch and pull doesn't really leave room for debate on what I mean. You could see it as you could see it also as the kids went in the pool and drowned at the end.
Let's get there because all three of us on our bottom three, the bewitching pool was hands down, and I think it is considered hands down. Like I don't know of anyone who has admitted to liking it, and I did a little research online before this, and that and it seems to be, you know, considered, and it is the last episode ever, correct?
Yes.
So before we go, just really quickly,
you do before, your favorites, right?
Yes. So I liked Nick of Time. I know
I like Nick of Time better than Terra at 50,000.
So much. And part of it, I feel like, is because that one, I don't know if it's that it's just been parodied too much for me to even like take it seriously. But I think Nick of Time has a really good quality. I mean, to me, it's a really good representation of somebody with OCD. And that's kind of how I've always read it. But in general, I found William. So the two with William Shatner is the one with him on the plane and the gremlin on the plane with the outfit that. Yeah, it's a little creepy. And SNL did actually something fairly funny a few years ago where it was like, I think Jude Law was that character, and like the gremlin, he was like hanging out with like Pearl Jam on the plane. Anyway, that was that, and like that, and like the amount of times it's been parodied, I'm just like, you know, maybe that's ruined it for me. But Nick of Time, it just feels very real. It's this couple, they're, you know, and this guy, he's so, William Shatner's character, he so wants to have control over his own fate, but he's giving it to this fortune-telling machine, which he's allowing dictate every move. And to me, again, that read as OCD to me.
Sure.
His fiance, I was always like, it's always weird. Like, are they married? Are they engaged? Because she does say, am I ever going to get married? I think at one point.
I remember them as being married, but
I thought so too. And now it might just be my, you know, and I've seen this episode so many times, I'm surprised that I'm trying to remember this in my mind. But she to me, and I'm gonna, because I counterbalance,
no, I think they're married. I think the line she's saying is like, this might be wrong, but maybe like he's trying to find out if he's gonna get that promotion,
right?
So maybe he says something like, will I be Mrs. Vice President or something like that. I think that might be what you're remembering.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna look back on it. I mean, there were a lot of questions, but I think like one of the things, and I always play this against one of my least favorite episodes, which is The Fever. Like, she's like one of the women who's not a nagging wife, who's supportive, but at the same time is like, you've got to get your together. Like, you've got to stop handing your fate over to ridiculous things like this crazy little devil machine that's giving you very vague fortunes.
They are very similar. One is great and one is terrible.
Terrible. But again, we'll get there. And I loved it. And I loved her. And I love just the whole, you know, idea. And the twist at the end to that is interesting, too. Because we find out, you know, they do eventually leave. And he says, oh, I'm going to take charge. But then another couple comes in, sits down at the same machine, and it seems like they're kind of going through the same thing. So is it the machine? Is it in his mind? Is it in their mind? It just, I love it.
Right.
My
favorite. I mean, I should say I love all three that Megan named, and I've loved, so far I've loved all the ones that have been named.
As a librarian, I kind of have to say I love The Obsolete Man. And to me, like, it's funny that both episodes with Burgess Meredith are book-based. And also, I know, like, everybody loves Time
Meredith. I that's one of my favorites too.
I love Time Enough at Last in the way, but again, that's another one that's been so parodied by everything. And I think I'm even going to call this episode Time Enough at Last just because, you know, library. But Burgess Meredith's character, who's not as sloppy as the character he is, you know, in Time Enough at Last, he's a librarian. And he's going to be executed for being obsolete and for being into books and for, you know, like holding some sort of belief. And he's in like this chamber with what, like an inquisitor from, I guess, the government. And in the end, it just kind of turns around really well. But that one really just kind of speaks to my heart as a librarian in general, especially as time goes on and things evolve and people will say, they'll be like, oh, well, libraries, like, you know, like, are you guys busy? Do people come in? And yes, they do. But, you know, the idea of being obsolete, which, again, like decades and decades ago, and that term is used much more, you know, in a clinical sense. It just, it really spoke to me.
There are two things in that episode that I think are so interesting and that I really love about it. One, he's a librarian. He's also, so he's, but he's also intellectual. He doesn't want to stake dogma and he doesn't want to be dumbed down and he loves books and he loves words and he loves ideas. The thing that's really interesting about that episode, though, is he's also devoutly religious.
Yes.
And often in literature, science and faith are cast against each other.
Right.
This, they were like that. It was, yes, a very interesting portrayal. And what they do have in common is that a fascist state like this is would,
right,
be down with religion and with science because it wants to be the new god and it doesn't want any facts to disprove that it's all powerful. So I love that. The other thing that cracks me up, though, is the chancellor gives a big monologue about how books are useless. But it's so eloquent and it's so clearly written by somebody who's read so many books.
Yes.
Ink in your veins, Mr. Wordsworth.
And of course that's his name. Because why wouldn't it be, you know? It's really just like, it's so good. It is. And I mean, it's really difficult for me to pick this third one because I have so many that I love. But I did pick Mirror Image because I feel like I don't see it enough. Whenever I'm watching the marathon, I feel like I really want them to play it and they don't. But that one is a young woman on her own in a she's at a bus station and she thinks she sees someone who looks exactly like her. Nobody else, well, people do see her, this doppelganger, because the doppelganger does crazy things like asks questions at the desk from the, you know, about the bus, when it's going to leave, and moves her her suitcase. But nobody realizes that it's two different people, or is it? And she finds a very sympathetic man. You know, everybody else is like saying, oh, lady is cuckoo, go take her away. She finds a very sympathetic man who in the end does, you know, he seems very conflicted about it. He does call the authorities to take her away. And then, of course, suddenly his doppelganger shows up. But I just love it. The sense of paranoia in that one. And it feels like, because another favorite of mine is the one where the 13th floor, where she's a mannequin. Spoiler.
It's one of my favorites, too.
After Hours is definitely one of my favorites.
After Hours. It's definitely got that feeling of paranoia.
That's such a creepy. I think, hands down, if you had to say the scariest episode, I would probably say the After Hours.
Top three. That, I would say The Devil Doll, the talking
Living
Tina.
Doll,
talking,
yes,
talking,
yeah,
Tito
talking
with
doll,
Telly Savalas.
Yeah.
and that it probably I would agree. They rebooted After Hours in the 80s series and they screwed it up completely.
Oh no, I have actually not seen it and now I kind of want to watch it just to see how badly they screwed it up.
The thing is, After Hours, like so many of the episodes, are about people figuring out who they are or what they are or where they are. So that's and you know, After Hours really isn't like a twist ending. By the time you know what's going on, you know these people are mannequins that are alive. You might not know the details, but like not every Twilight Zone is a whoa, big surprise ending. It's like you gradually learn it. And those were like Nightmare as a Child would be another one like that.
That one is great. I do enjoy that one.
That's one of my all-time favorites, too. And that's, I think, a wildly underrated one.
So underrated.
I agree. That's a great episode.
All right. So now those are the good ones.
Okay. So bad. 1, 2, 3. Everybody's least favorite episode is the
It's not my least favorite.
What'd you say? It's not your least favorite?
I don't think Bewitching Pool is the worst. It's in my bottom three.
Oh.
But
maybe
not,
Black Leather Jackets.
Black Leather Jackets
is
terrible. But the Bewitching Pool. So it is the last episode ever. I always kind of wondered, like, where he just like, I don't even care anymore. I'm just going to put this out.
It's Earl Hamner who also wrote Black Leather Jackets, but then who went on to do The Waltons and became very rich, and then did, I think, Knott's Landing after that.
Clearly, but horror was not his forte.
So here's the deal. I have no proof for this. Absolutely no proof for this. But I have a theory that there was a first draft of Bewitching Pool that got turned around. I think it's a much more logical and much better episode if we imagine that, I forget her name, that grandma who lives in the cottage that they run away to. if we just think of her like a Hansel and Gretel witch, that she's actually evil. That, she's a bad person bringing them in with candy.
She's actually cooking the kids in the pies.
That's what make it more interesting. That's what I was waiting for in that episode. Like, there's a really good book, and I wonder if it was at all inspired by this, by Clive Barker, I think, called The Thief of Always. And it's got that idea of luring children into this folksy gingerbread world, and you know, the granny character, like, they're not nice. And that's what I mean, because the plot is
the two kids, their parents are getting a divorce, and the parents are very awful.
They're terrible.
To the kids. They're horrible.
And to each other, and to, like, in general, they're just horrible.
So the two kids find, like, this nice gingerbread house with this grandmother in it. That's what I would call it, the gingerbread
house.
But they
swim to the bottom of their pool, and they don't come out. So there's, like, a vortex in their pool. And it's not like Willoughby, where they're killing themselves to get there, because they come out again and they see their terrible parents and they're just like, ugh.
Right, but everything about it makes, and the granny turns
so much more sense.
It's a safe place to run away, but everything about her makes sense as an evil character. She tells them, like, if you leave me, you won't go back. You won't be able to go to your parents. And mm-hmm. she's feeding them, but now suddenly she's putting them to work. It could have been a fantastically dark episode.
Yes.
And I feel like it started that way, and Rod said, nah, we can't do this, or somebody said it.
I think so that episode also had like weird dubbing. June Foray, who's known for
Rocky the Squirrel
and many other things too, she, like, in the Smurfs, and I mean pretty much like
she was the Mel Blanc of the female Mel Blanc. No one did more voices than she, except for Mel Blanc, who did Bugs Bunny and everything.
Yes.
And she did Talking Tina. She's the doll.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yes.
And Talking Tina was based on the real doll, Chatty Cathy. But she did Chatty Cathy too. I don't even know how that
was.
That's
meta.
And the thing parodying it, you'd think there'd be like a non-compete clause in
her
contract.
That is so meta. I love it.
But wait, I have to jump in. So everyone agrees Bewitching Pool sucks.
Not
and
good.
No one thinks Caesar and Me is good, but I want to stand really hard and say Caesar and Me is by far the worst episode.
That's
the
second mannequin episode, right?
That's right.
Something that's one of the worst. I don't like mannequins, but that episode does
make your case.
It's the same dummy from the Cliff Robertson episode, The Dummy.
Which by the way, every horror anthology has to have a dummy. I had a conversation with this about someone at Long Island Library Conference the other day, because R.L. Stine has Slappy, and I think, like, Are You Afraid of the Dark has, everybody has a dummy. But I didn't know that it was the same dummy.
In both episodes, the same dummy, but it's not the same character.
No,
there's nothing about this episode that makes any friggin' sense. It's just about a guy and his dummy who commit crimes. He's like Edwin G. Robinson, like, hey, let's rob a bank. We should go rob a bank. And then at the end, they bust him, and he turns to his dummy, and he goes, and he's doing this brogue. And he's like, oh, tell him it was, you were in on it all the time. It's like, how, even if the dummy spoke right now, how is that a defense? You're still saying you robbed the bank.
You still robbed the bank, dude, even if it's with the talking dummy.
And it was written by William Frog's secretary. Okay, so there was the fifth season producer. His secretary wrote the script. She went on to write A Gilligan's Island after that. That's it.
That's kind of sad, because I'm a fan of the Peggy Olsons of the world who go up from being a secretary and do great things. But I mean, some people like Gilligan's Island.
DC Fontana, who wrote some of the best Star Treks, started in the word pool.
Excellent.
And G. Ron Perry. So that's your example.
There we go. But yeah, I guess, you know, some people enjoyed Gilligan's Island. Some people.
Well, I like it too, but it's not, you know, you wouldn't. Think
no, it's not. It's not by any means like. I don't know. I mean, I did sit and watch that entire movie wrap up where they got off the island only to end up back on the island. Spoiler alert.
1976. Yeah.
But
Black Leather Jackets. Talk about
so
that.
So bad, Megan.
They'll have that one.
That
on
episode is another one that I feel like has no plot. It's these two aliens in black leather jackets, like, just drive into this house, and there's like a robot with three heads there, and that's what I remember from that episode. Because,
well, the thing is, it's an alien takeover, and they don't want to attract attention to their plan, so they get three guys to dress up like beatniks and ride around in motorcycles and then rent a house with no furniture? This is a superior alien race?
I think I was trying really hard to think. I'm like, is this anti-beatnik or is this like pro? I don't know. I didn't know. I was just like sitting there. I'm like, this is dumb.
We covered it on my show, we speculated that it was just like someone like, there were just too many notes from too many people, like something with aliens and robots. We like robots and the kids, they like that music and the leather jackets and motorcycles and a girl next door. She should be pretty. And it's just this mix and it makes no sense. But the thing that really kills me is that, remember, these aliens have mind control and the James Deaney looking alien wants to save humanity because he's in love with literally the girl next door, who's Shelley Fabares from Coach.
Nice.
And he's trying to prove to them that he's an alien and they don't believe him. But like, he doesn't do things like use his telekinesis or do any of the things that we know he could do. He's just pleading with them. Makes no sense.
So yeah, Black Leather Jackets was terrible. I think my top worst. I'm just so The Fever, I think I mentioned we've already covered Bewitching Pool.
Yeah.
The Fever, so that one is about a couple, an older couple who go to, like, one of them becomes addicted to the specific slot machine, which again, like, I always pair it up with Nick of Time in my mind, because again, you're addicted to this machine, but, and his wife is like hugging him throughout the whole thing, like, please, please come back. And he's terribly abusive to her.
Terrible.
And terribly abusive. And like, no, like at first, like, he's like, gambling's evil. And then he's like, but I'm going to gamble a lot because he ends up out the window and it's bad.
Well, what is his name?
I can't remember.
The slot machine actually starts saying his name, like Oscar. Or
yeah.
Like Roswell. It's got some dumb.
Yeah.
It's one of the worst.
And I guess it's supposed to look like a face smiling because it shows up at the window when he jumps out, which, does it have legs? Like, how did it get there? Was that supposed to be scary?
Coming after him. Yeah. It's very bad. It's very bad. I don't think it's in my, it's definitely not my worst five, but it's my worst 10.
And my next one, and I have to say, and I do like the passerby, and it is folksy, and I generally don't like overly folksy episodes.
Oh right, I know. Sorry,
but it's not the one. I don't think you this is the one that I think, because there's one that I know everybody loves, and I'm just kind of like, it's a little like saccharine for me. But the one that I don't like, Jess Bell. I feel like it's like this guy, he fooled around with this woman who is like a wanton woman, and she wants him to fall in love with her, but he's in love with the sweet blonde who's, I don't know, like never done a thing, and right. She becomes a witch too. And there's like this folk song that's ongoing through the whole thing, and I'm just like, this is just stupid. Like, there's nothing about this episode that I enjoy. I wanted, like, at the end, like, I was rooting for Jess Bell. I'm like, what?
Oh, yeah, of course. Jess Bell's an hour long, and it's really hard to see.
It was an hour long one. It felt like it was 3 hours long.
There's only one hour long that I really like, which is Thursday We Leave for Home, which is about the first colonists it's not Mars, but it's, and it turns out to be a gazillion times more arduous than they thought. Nothing grows. They're on near starvation. And just through the power and the strength of this kindly father figure, he keeps all their hopes up for about 25, 30 years until they're rescued. And then when they get rescued, he doesn't want to lose his standing as a messiah. So he doesn't go home and he dies alone on the planet.
I do like an hour episode. I really like the Robert Duvall episode, The Dollhouse. I don't know if that rings a bell.
I always
anyone.
Forget that one's an hour long.
Yeah, when I was a little boy, when colorization first came in, they would do it really badly and everyone looked really pastel. They did a very special viewing of this episode, which I'd never seen because they never showed the hour longs on commercial TV. And they colorized only the portions of the episode that were in the house. The miniatures.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's interesting. I think that would add to it because it's really like that was really the life that he was living. He wasn't really living in his own life. And
yeah, he kind of got, it's weird how people get typecast and sometimes not. Like, He's kind of like a Boo Radley character.
Yes, exactly. He is. And I always say that, yeah, and I always say that that character, you know, like nowadays, you know, when we discuss, you know, neurotypical, and we have just a little bit more, either not so much understanding, but awareness of just how different people process things. I feel like that character very much would be processed differently in a modern eye. That's just kind of how I feel when I read, when I watch that episode.
Just a one sentence on, I agree with you, and a one sentence on typecasting. I forget his name, but the actor from Thursday We Leave for Home, the one who kills himself rather than leave after 30 years on a harsh planet, is the same actor who then in Shawshank Redemption plays Brooks, the old guy who, when he's finally released from prison, can't deal with it and kills himself.
I didn't know that. Shawshank Redemption is also incredible. Written by a horror author, Stephen King.
Yeah, Stephen King wrote a little bit of or at least they adapted Stephen King stories in the 80s reboot. Harlan Ellison adapted a Stephen King short story called Mother for the reboot that people like, but I don't.
So, I mean, just like we have like a few minutes left. I don't want to go too long, but maybe just like throw out just a few others that you enjoy, maybe some that you think are overrated
or underrated. I'm the only person who doesn't like, well, that's not true. Anne Serling's not crazy about it either. And actually, there's Mark Dowidziak. Time Enough at Last. I know.
I was just going to say that I'm not crazy about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I know it's a classic, but it just seems mean for no reason. It's a punishment he doesn't deserve. And it just seems gratuitous.
I agree. And I think as someone with vision issues, I was like, this is so horrible. And it's just why? It's just like that. This doesn't seem like a moralistic tale. It's not even like it's a person that had it coming to them. It's like, why
not at
him?
All? Yeah. Of all the people, like he deserved to just sit and read and not be screamed at and berated for liking
books.
Yeah, the
wife in that episode is so horrible. So it just
we could
so
do a whole
worse. It's such a
2-hour podcast on nagging wives in the Twilight Zone.
Well, right, but there's good and bad, and she's not only the worst wife in the
she's
Twilight
terrible.
Zone.
Willoughby is bad too, though. She's awful.
That's true. She might be the worst person in the Twilight Zone. She might actually be the worst person in the Twilight Zone.
She threw his book in the fireplace. I mean,
yeah, no, who? She's like literally a psychopath. She crossed out every single page in a book. That's called the cops. Like, the murderer is inside the house.
So talking about just like throwing things in the fireplace, and I'm forgetting the name of it. What's the one where the writer creates characters and
Zone.
Which one?
It's called World of His Own. It's the last it's the last episode in season one.
Yeah, that one. Like I have mixed feelings about it, but I do enjoy it in the end.
It's really, that's the one that Alex Rubens wanted to talk about when he did my Intangible Quarter podcast, the guy who wrote The Comedian. If you look at it, it's portrayed as like a light comedy, but if you look at it, he's a monster.
He so is.
Absolute sociopath. He creates life and loves it, and then deprives it of love, and kills it over and over again. He's just as rotten as the little boy from. Funny that nobody picked that.
Well, yes.
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a good life. I was going to mention that's one of my favorite episodes.
I didn't like that episode until I was on the brink of having children. I was like, "This is stupid. This is so silly." Like, yes, it's supposed to feel, you know, but I. Maybe again it was one of those overly parodied ones and I just felt like it was hokey, and then like I'm 2 seconds, not literally, but you know, I'm like, I'm watching the Twilight Zone marathon and I'm 7 months pregnant and I'm like, oh my god, this is terrifying.
This was a precursor to The Omen, in my opinion. Like, this kid is downright horrible.
And it's based on a short story, isn't it, where the child is much younger. I think he's 3 in the short. Is he younger in the short story?
I think he's the same age, but they tell you more about his earlier life. And well, I'm forgetting it. I read the short story when we covered it on my show. And what was the interesting detail? Oh, well, it's told from his perspective. And so because it's told from his perspective, it's a lot more sympathetic, because since the time he was like three, people have been trying to kill him. Like, there was a lynch mob, and he just had to make the whole world go away, like, as a child.
I found it so interesting that on, if you watched on air on Sci-Fi or one of the other general stations, they omit the beginning part of the episode, which basically says that the whole world is basically gone, except for that one farm area where they are. And I just thought, wow, why did they take
like
away
Rod
something like
by
that?
The map. Like, Rod's like standing by a map, and he's explaining it. They take that out.
They take that out in a lot of the Sci-Fi airings I've seen.
Even though it wasn't great, when they got the whole original cast back in the early 2000s to play, you know, they got Mummy? I always mispronounce. Mummy. They got, is it Cloris Leachman?
Cloris Leachman,
and then
yeah.
they got his daughter. They got his daughter to play Anthony's daughter, which I'm like, I can't remember if Anthony created this daughter or if he actually had a wife who he banished.
Good point.
That was just like, even though it wasn't great, it was kind of fun. What is it? I like when they pull folklore in, like the Vanishing Hitchhiker stories, or they have the one where the guy Going My Way.
That's a sad episode.
And I think that actress met a sad end.
She did.
She did, and she's also in Lateness of the Hour, where she realizes she's an android.
She's
a great one. She's great in both of those. Yes, she did commit suicide, which is a drag. You know, that was a short story written by a woman whose name I can't remember, but she wrote a lot of things. She wrote Sorry, Wrong Number, which is a great noir. And actually, in her short story, it was a man, and she was annoyed that Rod Serling changed it to a woman.
Really?
And Rod's daughter was annoyed that she gave him the name Nan, which was his nickname for her. He's like, you gave the dead person my name?
Where is everybody? I mean, just the pilot. I thought that was an incredibly creepy episode.
When I was a kid, that was the scariest to me.
Really?
Yeah, just the idea of waking up and nobody being around anywhere.
Or no one can interact with you. You're in this world and there's nothing. That's working. It's seemingly working and nothing is exactly quite right.
There's two with Elizabeth Montgomery, and one is good, although the end makes my sister-in-law and I groan. It's the one where it's called Two, and there's two of them. There's a war, opposite ends of a war, and they're always fighting. But then in the end, like, she puts on a dress and smiles, and he's like, all right, Nan, that's better. And like, I think like that's the point. My sister-in-law and I are like, okay. But up until in general, I do like that episode a lot.
I like that episode. And she's still a badass. She's like,
she totally is. But I think I don't know.
That Charles Bronson and her, I like that one very much. I want to do that as a couple's costume one year, but no one would know what it was. And the one that I want to just talk about before we go, Perchance to Dream. You know that one?
Yeah.
The one where the guy, he says he can't fall asleep because he's got a weak heart and there's that like cat lady coming to kill him.
Oh, that one is always, that actually is one in my least favorite episodes.
I was a child. I didn't realize how incredibly sexual it was.
Yes,
it's all the roller coaster and the going up and
so much.
Basically, it's a guy with a heart condition who's afraid to have a wet dream, and that's like really filthy on the air. But it went right over my head until I was watching it like in my late 30s, and I finally went, "Oh, that's what this episode is about."
I think the dubbing, even though it's a terrible episode of The Bewitching Pool, did they say damn those loudmouth kids? Was that the one that like came back twice? Like did she say that? Because I feel like that's like harsh words. Because I think they played that part twice. Damn those loudmouth kids. And I was saying to Megan the other day, I'm like, that was a pretty harsh curse word for those days.
Oh, I don't know.
Like at this point, everything is said on network television, except for maybe one word. But like back then, I was kind of wondering, I'm like, well, it's the last episode. Was he just like, I'm going to say damn on TV or because I can? Let me look back and that's not the line, but I'm pretty sure it is.
No, by the way, is that really so? Wasn't Gone with the Wind, Frank Lee Scarlett, I don't give a damn.
Oh, yeah, but that's like a movie that you pay to see. This is like on network TV.
There is a different standard. You're right. You're right. It was even harder on television. Yeah, I guess so. As far as firsts, it wasn't a first, but it was a second. In Praise of Pip, which is one of my favorite episodes, is only the second time the Vietnam War was ever mentioned on television. And he says, my boy's dying in Vietnam, and there's not even supposed to be a war there, which is pretty hardcore. And it's not like Rod wasn't a patriotic vet who served in World War II and had a Purple Heart and two injuries, but he was not behind Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking back to some of the war episodes that are some of my favorite, there's an episode with the samurai sword and George Takei.
I forgot
about that.
The Encounter, yeah. And that's a really strong acting performance, I feel like, from both of the actors. And I was like, and that's a heavy episode. Talk about the horribleness of war and, like, I feel like stereotyping George Takei. And the twist at the end of that is, like, very...
Well, apparently, I didn't realize this. It was a very controversial episode, and Asian Americans hated it because they thought it made Asians look bad because this person, that character's parents, his father, turned out to have actually been a spy. Now, we all know that Japanese internment was disgraceful and horrible, but I never thought that episode was saying you can't trust the Japanese. They were saying there was one Japanese person in America who was treasonous, and although there was no excuse for internment, I don't think history says there wasn't one single example of treason in America. So for a while, they refused to show that episode. But I think it only has a good intent, a non-racist intent, and is not trying to portray Asian Americans in a traitorous way at all. I agree with you. I think it's underrated.
I think like when you're writing something from a sensitive viewpoint, it's sometimes, you know, your intentions could be good, but it could be read differently, especially like, I mean, that's still, and George Takei, he does some like really great stuff. He had something on Broadway recently. I don't know if it's still there, called Allegiance, about the internment camps. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, yeah, it's supposed to have been good. I don't know if it's still running.
I think he was in an internment camp.
Yes, he was. And yeah. It's about his experience. Yes.
Right. So you would think that would speak to the episode's good intentions. Then again, one of the actors in Hogan's Heroes, was in an actual concentration camp, and you would think if he'd gone through that experience, he wouldn't want to have anything to do with a ridiculous show like Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, which like when I like every time I hear the premise of that, I'm like,
are
you
horrible show?
Like what?
It was banned. It was banned in the Serling home.
Oh,
not
my God.
Not allowed to be watching Rod Serling's home.
So anyway, I want to thank you so much. I mean, we could go on and on about this. And, you know, if we like, we can reconvene before the new year, if you're up for it.
Sure. And if you want, I can get you. I can see if Nick wants to do a future podcast in 6 months.
Let's do it.
He's an expert and he's got a book on Serling. So.
I'm down for that, Megan.
I am too.
All right. So, thank you again, Wayne Gladstone. We're gonna talk about your experiences in Syosset at some point. So we're going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.